Today's episode discusses the disappearance of a four-year-old and may include details that are disturbing to some. Listener discretion is advised. Four-year-old Nylene Marshall loved playing outside. The streams, hills, grass, and forest were her playground, and living in rural Montana provided a very large sandbox. On June 25, 1983, Nylene was excited to accompany her family to a picnic in the Helena National Forest. It would be an afternoon of fun and games, sandwiches, and exploration. Unfortunately, Nylene would not come home. Sometime around 4 p.m., Nylene was last seen near a creek less than 100 yards from the rest of the picnic goers. When her family came to locate her, she was nowhere to be found, and it quickly became clear that the four-year-old was missing. Subsequent searches and investigations would reveal details of an unidentified man seen speaking with the child in the moments before she vanished. Over the course of the next 40 years, multiple sightings of Nylene were reported around the country. Composite sketches of the man with her sparked investigations into all manner of suspects, and Nylene's family struggled to deal with her absence. Then came a series of letters and phone calls from a man who claimed not only to have abducted Nylene in 1983, but that he was still in possession of her and raising her as his own daughter. What became of Nylene Marshall? Could she still be alive out there, more than 40 years old, with no clue as to her true identity? Was the child abducted and murdered within hours of her disappearance? Or perhaps is her fate tied to something yet to be revealed? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 80, The Disappearance of Nylene K. Marshall. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the haunting disappearance of four-year-old Nylene Marshall. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focusing on a different unsolved case each week. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at TraceEvPod, on Instagram at TraceEvidencePodcast, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, social media links, merchandise, and more. As a final note, Trace Evidence is a complete one-man operation, so if you'd like to help support the podcast, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can gain rewards such as stickers, pins, and other surprises. If Patreon isn't your thing, but you still want to pitch in, there is a PayPal donation button on the website. Today, we examine the haunting disappearance of four-year-old Nylene Marshall. It's a disturbing case with very little evidence, but a lot of creepy possibilities. This is Episode 80, The Disappearance of Nylene K. Marshall. Nylene K. Marshall was born on September 18, 1978, to her mother, Nancy Marshall. Nylene would ultimately be raised by Nancy and a stepfather named Kim. At the time of her birth, Nylene had one older sibling, and a little sister would come along later. Nylene was raised in the community of Clancy, Montana. Clancy is an unincorporated community located in Jefferson County, in the southwest quadrant of the state, with a landmass of more than 39 square miles and a population of just 1,661. Clancy is far from a robust and bustling town, but for Nancy and her children, it seemed an opulent location to raise a family. Clancy is located just 12 miles south of Helena, the Montana state capital, and as a result, many residents of Clancy work in Helena and make the short drive north along Interstate 15. Nylene was a beautiful baby with dark hair and striking blue eyes. Nancy was focused on her then youngest child and head over heels for her daughter from the first moment she saw her. Nylene was, by all accounts, a good child who was never too fussy and slept through the night. I should note, there isn't a vast amount of information available regarding Nylene's home life or even her biological father, but what information does exist seems to present a basic family setup with nothing that stood out of the ordinary. Friends and family described the family as close, happy, and with only the typical issues a family usually encounters. Frequently, Nancy, Kim, and the children would go off into the wilderness for hikes, fun, and adventures. As a result of this, the children were taught safety procedures, the basics essentially, and instructed on proper behavior in that kind of environment. Knowing how easily someone could get lost, injured, or both, it was important to the family to ensure that the kids were aware that while the forest around them was beautiful and fun, it could also be dangerous. By the time Nylene was 4 years old in 1983, she had developed into a sweet, lovable, and courteous little girl. Nylene had grown to love the outdoors, and whenever possible, she wanted to play outside, kick off her shoes, get her hands dirty, and just have fun until the sun went down. Bear in mind that the year was 1983, and the approach to parenting was quite different than we view it today. Parents generally allowed their children to go a little further, a little younger than we might do today, though Nancy did keep up with her daughter more than most did at the time. Nylene was especially excited that summer when in June it was announced that they would be going on a picnic into the Elkhorn Mountains in the Helena National Forest. For a young girl who loved both her family and the fun and freedom of the outdoors, there was little more which could have been appealing. The Elkhorn Mountains are part of the Rocky Mountains and cover approximately 300,000 acres of land. The Helena National Forest covers more than 980,000 acres and is split into several different sections, from the Big Belt Mountains of the east to the Scapegoat Wilderness of the west. The region, dense and challenging, is known historically as a location which the famed explorers Lewis and Clark passed through during their expedition to the west. To the south are the Elkhorn Mountains, jutting through a forest of grass, sagebrush, fir, and spruce trees. Reportedly, Nylene's stepfather was a member of the Capital City Amateur Radio Club, headquartered in Helena. The club involves itself in the local community through multiple events, including endurance runs and outdoor activities. On June 25, 1983, they organized a family-style picnic which would take place in the National Forest, and the Marshall family attended. The picnic was a fun event according to those who attended, with multiple families playing games and running around. It was a lot of fun for everyone involved, and Nylene was no different. The four-year-old had thrown off her shoes and socks and was playing with the other kids, trying to keep up and just laughing and having a good time. While the area was beautiful, there were a certain number of dangers to be aware of. This particular location was tucked between some steep, rocky embankments, and there were abandoned mine shafts in the area as well. According to children who were with Nylene at the time, the group of them ran through the forest, played in and around a creek, and even discovered the remnants of an old cabin, which they explored until they were ready to move on. At one point, Nylene sat down near some beaver dams on the creek, and the children she was with decided to move on. They began walking forward, expecting Nylene to follow along, but when they turned around, she was nowhere to be seen. Nylene had been seen for the last time at approximately 4 p.m., The location in which Nylene had last been seen was less than 100 yards from where the picnic was taking place. Initially, when Nylene disappeared, the other children thought she was still in the area playing. They called out her name a few times, though they received no response. Being just children themselves, when Nylene failed to reappear, they assumed she'd just gone off on her own, found another friend to play with, or was hiding. As a result, the children pressed onward and eventually came out of the woods in the area of the picnic to reconnect with their families. When Nylene's parents realized she hadn't returned with them, they asked where she was and were informed that she hadn't been seen since they had been near the beaver dams. Immediately concerned that Nylene could have gotten lost or hurt, Nancy and Kim went into the forest to search for her. Unfortunately, there was no sign of the four-year-old, and what began as concern quickly grew into panic. Many people attending the picnic, both known to the Marshall family and strangers alike, heard about the disappearance and joined in to help with the search. Large clusters of people entered the forest, and Nylene's name could be heard echoing through the trees, but there was never a response. It was strange to everyone. How far could a barefoot four-year-old really get? Nancy, though, was convinced that her daughter didn't run off somewhere and that something else must have happened. When asked about this later, Nancy replied, quote, "Nylene was trained about the woods and safety. I know she did not wander off," end quote. If Nylene hadn't wandered off, that only left a few options, and none of them were comforting. Either the child had fallen into a body of water, had encountered a wild animal, or someone had taken her. With few results and daylight dwindling, the decision was made to drive to a phone and contact the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department. Knowing that the area was difficult and the terrain challenging, the Sheriff's Department didn't hesitate to also reach out to locals familiar with the forest, as well as the Lewis and Clark Search and Rescue Team. The initial searchers for Nylene were composed of sheriff's deputies, local law enforcement, members of the search and rescue team, as well as hundreds of volunteers. The first steps were to determine the boundaries of a search area, which was based on how far it was believed a barefoot four-year-old could make it in the hours that had passed. Groups of volunteers and officials were banded together, lined up within a few yards of one another, and sent into the forest to conduct a grid search. As night fell, it became dangerous and risky to continue the search, and so it was decided to pick it back up early the next day. During the night, the Sheriff's Department was able to contact the FBI, through whom they were able to acquire the use of a helicopter suited with heat-seeking cameras. The second day of the search was thorough and exhaustive. Hundreds of volunteers returned, in addition to law enforcement and search and rescue teams. A local man who owned a tracking dog was also called in to assist. The man's dog had been used to track and locate more than 30 missing persons over the years and was considered highly trained and skilled. The dog was given Nylene's scent off some of her clothing and almost immediately upon entering the forest, picked up the young girl's scent. Unfortunately, almost as quickly as the dog had obtained Nylene's trail, he lost it just a short distance into the forest and was never able to pick it up again. This was astounding to investigators who couldn't understand why the young woman's trail just stopped in the middle of nowhere. Over the course of the next 10 days, the search would comb every inch of the forest in a multi-mile radius spun out from the spot at which Nylene had last been seen. Searchers climbed down into dark and dangerous mine shafts abandoned nearly 100 years ago, but found nothing. Special divers were brought in and went down into the ponds, though nothing was found in them either. The challenge of the terrain was certainly making the search difficult, with searchers having to cut through dense forestry and ascend steep peaks. Towards the end of the search, heavy equipment was brought in to turn over the earth. Later, several nearby ponds were completely drained, but again, absolutely nothing was found. In an interview with Unsolved Mysteries, Sheriff Tim Campbell stated, quote, "The dogs weren't successful. The grid search was unsuccessful. There was absolutely nothing to indicate if she was even there," end quote. On the fifth day of the search, the amount of volunteers had declined, and the number of law enforcement officials dedicated to the case had to be reduced. As the police and family were beginning to lose hope, the skies grew dark and the weather took a turn for the worse. Storms and heavy rains battered the area, halting the search and essentially damaging or destroying any hopes of discovering evidence or tracks that might reveal where Nylene had gone. In the early days of the search, law enforcement believed it was highly likely the four-year-old had simply wandered into the forest and gotten lost. It was believed she would be located quickly, but following days of searching, without a single hint of her possible location, their theory began to move towards foul play. There were a lot of people who had attended the picnic, and this meant there were a lot of interviews to be conducted in hopes of determining what may have happened. During these interviews, the most important people that police wanted to speak with were the children who last reported seeing Nylene. It was during the questioning of the children that authorities and Nylene's family first learned that there may in fact have been someone in the forest that day who didn't belong. Two little girls who had been walking hand in hand in the area from which Nylene disappeared reported seeing an adult male step out from behind a tree. According to the girls, they did not recognize the man as belonging to the group that was at the picnic that day. The man, described as having dark hair and being dressed in a purple jogging suit, reportedly approached Nylene and engaged the four-year-old in conversation while she took a seat on a large rock. The conversation wasn't fully heard, though one of the girls did report hearing Nylene say to the man, "My brother can run faster than you." According to the girls, the man had addressed them in conversation as well, but they'd ignore him. One girl later said that they had run away from the man, though the other said they simply kept walking. Both stated that the last time they saw Nylene, she was sitting on a rock with her legs crossed, speaking with the man. Facing this new information, police began speaking with more of the children, even those who hadn't been playing with Nylene that afternoon, and it wasn't long before they began gathering more sightings of this mysterious man. Another child, an 8-year-old, didn't report hearing any conversation between the two, but did state that when she passed that area, she saw the man and Nylene speaking, and before she walked away, she said she saw the man slowly making his way closer to Nylene. The last thing she saw was the man taking steps towards Nylene, and again, the description matched that of a dark-haired older male dressed in purple. A 6-year-old boy also claimed to have had an encounter with the man and Nylene. According to his story, he overheard the man speaking with Nylene. While he didn't remember the full conversation, he did say that he remembers the man at some point asking Nylene if she liked to play games. One of the games this man reportedly called Follow the Shadows. The boy reported hearing the man explaining the game, and then he heard Nylene responding, something along the lines of, "I have to follow the shadows." This is the last believed to be confirmed sighting of Nylene that took place close to 4 p.m., the time that she's officially listed as being a missing person. Others at the picnic that day reported seeing a man fitting the description the children had given, though at the time, they had assumed he was just part of the picnic. It's important to note, however, he was not seen following Nylene's disappearance. For authorities, this seemed to confirm their belief that Nylene had been abducted and likely had not been in the forest. This meant that whoever had taken Nylene, if indeed it was the man in purple, had many days to get far away from where they had been searching, and by this time, Nylene could be anywhere. In response to witness statements, police officially declared Nylene's case that of a likely child abduction. Utilizing the descriptions of the children and several adults, a composite sketch was developed which appeared to closely resemble the man seen near Nylene the day she vanished. The composite was distributed around the state of Montana, as well as neighboring states Idaho, Wyoming, North, and South Dakota. Eventually, the composite would make its way across the country. Initially, there were a few leads. Some members of law enforcement in different areas believed that the composite resembled different men known for crimes involving children, such as abductions and child pornography. One man was currently wanted for the abduction and murder of a child, and investigators focused in on these possible suspects. Upon a visit to one of the apartments of a potential suspect, authorities recovered a photograph of a dark-haired, light-eyed young girl who appeared to be of similar age to Nylene. According to law enforcement, the young woman in the picture was bruised and appeared to have been assaulted. For Nylene's family, it was a complete nightmare. Nancy was shattered at the loss of her child, but she had to keep it together for Nylene's older brother and younger sister. The heartbroken mother was determined to bring her daughter home. Nancy believed that Nylene was still out there somewhere, having been taken, and that there was still hope in finding her. The family went through a number of sources and had missing persons flyers created and distributed coast to coast. Nylene was added into several databases, including the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, who would, over the years, develop age-progressed photographs of Nylene. It was actually NC Mech who would utilize photograph experts to determine that the girl depicted in the photo, found in a potential suspect's apartment, was not, in fact, Nylene. I should note that, during the initial phase of the investigation, the Marshall family were all interviewed by investigators separately. The details of these interviews have never been revealed to the public, but for one reason or another, authorities considered Nylene's stepfather, Kim, a person of interest early on in the investigation. There's never been much discussed about the reasoning behind this, and none of the witnesses in the area reported seeing Kim near Nylene before she vanished. In addition, the family has argued that it would have been impossible for Kim to have done anything with Nylene, as his whereabouts were known during the time that she vanished, and they didn't consider it possible that he could have taken the four-year-old, concealed her somewhere, and returned without being noticed and without Nylene being found. The next few months would be filled with difficult challenges and an emotional wear. Despite the extensive distribution of flyers depicting both Nylene and her possible abductor, little, if any, information trickled in. All of the suspects police spoke with, even those with a history of child abuse or abductions, seemed to be able to provide alibis for their whereabouts at the time. Nothing concrete could be found to connect anyone to Nylene's disappearance, and it was beginning to look like this would quickly become one of those cases that would haunt investigators. Following a few tips, a few potential suspects, and a lot of dead ends, Nylene's case began to grow cold. Despite the efforts of law enforcement and the family, there simply was nothing that seemed to suggest where Nylene could have been or who may have been involved. Sadly, the case would begin to grow cold, and for the next 3 years, there would be little, if any, movement. The next major clue in Nylene's disappearance came in November of 1985. Employees working for NC Mech received a series of phone calls from an anonymous male who claimed to be in possession of Nylene. While the exact statements made by the man haven't been revealed, it has been said that the man alleged to have taken Nylene and stated that she was well and being taken care of. This first call was only the beginning, as several more would come in. During these calls, it was reported that the man claimed to love Nylene and to be taking good care of her, but he allegedly also made statements that alluded to the fact that he was sexually abusing the child. NC Mech was highly disturbed by the initial call and contacted authorities, who in turn reached out to the FBI. After several other calls came in, made by the same man, making similar statements, the FBI was able to trace the calls to a series of payphones located in Edgerton, Wisconsin. Edgerton is located approximately 1,300 miles to the east and is a suburb of the city of Madison. Whether or not the caller somehow became aware of the traces, or simply decided not to call anymore, is unknown, but no further calls came in to NC Mech following the discovery of the payphone locations. While authorities were excited by the possibilities that the calls opened up, there was little which could be done to track down who the caller may have been. Additional flyers were distributed in the area, and local media was asked to report on the new development. Tips came in, but again, led to nowhere. Nylene's family tried to take some comfort in the calls, believing that their daughter may still be alive somewhere, though the details surrounding how she was being treated and what may have been done to her was disturbing and horrifying. In January of 1986, just 2 months after the phone calls had begun, a series of letters were mailed with Madison, Wisconsin as their postmark. Remember, Madison is quite close to Edgerton, where the calls had come from. One letter was sent to Child Finds of America, a missing children's organization based out of New York. Another letter, which has been reported to have been extremely similar to the first letter, was sent to law enforcement in Madison. The letters alleged that the man had found Nylene in the forest, had taken her as his own daughter, and that he was treating her well. In at least one of the letters, he made note of the fact that he was not molesting her, though this seems to contradict statements made on the phone calls, leading some to wonder if this was truly the same man or not. Whether or not he was, police did take him seriously, as he allegedly discussed details of Nylene's disappearance, that were known only to the family and law enforcement, suggesting that he indeed may have been the one who took young Nylene. While the letters again sparked interest in the case and gave investigators new angles to explore, they too failed to lead to any results. The letters, however, did give investigators and the family renewed hope that Nylene may be alive. She had been missing for nearly 2 years, and it was considered possible that the longer she was gone, the less likely she was to remember her family or even the knowledge that she had been abducted. For law enforcement, it was considered possible that Nylene lived with this man and believed he was actually her father. The more time passed, the more this became likely. A final letter, allegedly sent by the same man, arrived at the home of Nancy and Kim Marshall, and again had been postmarked in Madison. I will now read an excerpt from this letter, though it does contain some information which is disturbing.
I picked Kay up on the road in the Elkhorn Park area between Helena and Boulder. She was crying and frightened, and as I held her, she was shaking, and I decided that I would keep her and love her. I took her home with me. I have a nice investment income, and I can work at home, so I care for her myself all the time. I teach her at home, and she likes to go with me when I travel. She would gladly recount to you trips to San Francisco, New York, Oklahoma City, New Orleans, Nashville, Chicago, Puerto Rico, and Canada. We were even in Britain for a month last year, and she loved it. Nobody questions passports. Her hair is short and curly now, and she has really grown. She's about 45 inches and around 50 pounds. She has all four of her permanent upper and two of her lower incisors at this time. She takes a bath and brushes her teeth every day. I give her medicine from the bathroom every morning. It's actually a spoonful of my semen. It doesn't affect her physically. I have never molested her in any other way. She is a sweet little girl, and it is because of how much I have grown to love her that I realize how much her family must miss her. But she has adjusted and seems happy. She trusts me and isn't afraid. We play a lot, and she laughs when we clown around. She smiles and acts coy when I tease her. She giggles when we snuggle and hugs me sometimes for no apparent reason. I love her, and I have her. I just can't let her go.
Obviously, the content of this letter is incredibly disturbing, though it does reveal some information about the alleged abductor that could help reveal his identity, assuming he's telling the truth. The man claims to have made money off investments and that he works from home. He travels a lot and possesses both a passport for himself and for Nylene, though he now calls her by her middle name, Kay, and likely any documentation bearing her name would show the same. Nylene is a rather unique name, and so calling her Kay is a good attempt to conceal her true identity. In other letters, law enforcement have reported that the man also claimed that he had a sister and parents who died in a car accident when his sister was 9 years old. Again, it's unknown how many of these details are accurate to the reality of the abductor's life. Law enforcement have speculated that, based on the locations listed, the man may have a job which requires him to travel, such as a salesman or truck driver. It's believed that he lived in the Madison area, though he may travel more than he's home. It was also believed that the man may have a female accomplice working with him. Sometime after the initial disappearance, Nylene's uncle spoke with law enforcement and stated that he had seen a flyer seeking two wanted individuals, a man and a woman. According to the uncle, the man and woman resembled individuals he had seen present on the first day of searching for Nylene. Authorities believe it's possible that Nylene could have been taken, and then her abductors volunteered in the search party to gather information about the progress of the investigation. Oftentimes, criminals will visit scenes of their crimes or participate in searches in order to gather information or to relive the thrill of the crime. Unfortunately, following this letter being sent to Nylene's parents, the case would once again begin growing cold. There were several sightings called in from around the country, and while none of these could be confirmed, it was considered possible if the man who had taken Nyleen was in fact traveling. That would explain why the young girl had allegedly been spotted in places such as Florida, New York, and California. Despite the sightings, nothing solid could ever be nailed down, and it wouldn't be until 1990 when a new lead came in. In the third season of Unsolved Mysteries, Nyleen's story was aired. The short segment discussed her disappearance and included interviews with law enforcement and Nancy. By this time, Nyleen would have been missing for 7 years and would have been 11 years old, turning 12. One viewer of the show thought the images of Nyleen and the composite sketch displayed looked familiar. The viewer, who was a young man at the time, contacted Unsolved Mysteries and reported that he believed Nyleen was actually a student in his school. Apparently, officials at the school, located in Vancouver, British Columbia, had also seen the episode and made their own calls regarding a female student known as Mary Ann Kelly. After receiving these calls, the tips were passed on to law enforcement, who began working with Canadian officials to conduct thorough background checks of Mary Ann Kelly, as well as her father, Robert Kelly. It didn't take long before it was discovered that these were not their true identities. Law enforcement moved in quickly and took Mary Ann Kelly into their care while Robert was taken in for questioning. For the first time since Nyleen's disappearance, there was a true hope that she may have finally been located. Law enforcement discovered that the girl had indeed been abducted, but were able to confirm it was not Nyleen. 5-year-old Monica Bonilla had been abducted by her biological father, Guillermo, from her mother's home in Burbank, California, on September 22, 1982. Guillermo was officially charged with parental child abduction, and Monica was returned to her mother in December of 1990, more than 8 years after she had been taken. Monica would find herself moving into her mother's home, where she would have a new stepfather and half-brother. While this was obviously a success for law enforcement and a happy ending to an otherwise difficult case, it did little to shine any light on Nyleen's disappearance. Reportedly, Nancy was very pleased that, in some way, her daughter's disappearance helped end the nightmare for another mother. The next year, in August of 1991, a mentally ill man who had been convicted of sexually assaulting a minor in 1984 walked into a police station and confessed to murdering a woman from Great Falls. After discussing this alleged murder, the man then added that he had also abducted and murdered Nyleen in the Helena National Forest the day she went missing. After taking down the man's confession, law enforcement requested that he give them the locations of the body of the woman he had murdered. The man, named Richard James Wilson, gave them a detailed set of directions, but nothing was ever recovered from the site he specified. After this, Wilson was taken into the Helena National Forest in the area from which Nyleen had been taken and asked to lead investigators to the location of her remains. Again, Wilson failed to lead investigators to anything. Without any evidence, his confession couldn't be taken seriously. Wilson later recanted this confession and was released due to a lack of evidence. Once again, investigators found themselves back to square one. Wilson was investigated for a period of time, and authorities did their best to determine whether or not he had been telling the truth, but no evidence could ever be found to link him to Nyleen. In 1994, 11 years after Nyleen's disappearance, her family finally decided to move away. Nancy's job took the family to Japan, where they would live for a year. During this time, Nancy was still focused on working to find Nyleen, but had to begin the process of moving on with her life. For the mother, she had 2 other children to take care of, and she couldn't just let herself sink into a depression. Over the years, Nancy had raised over $10,000 to offer as a reward for information regarding Nyleen's disappearance, and even recounted multiple times that her own children expressed their pain and anguish over Nyleen's vanishing. Reportedly, Nyleen's older brother Nathan missed his little sister a great deal and often played with her toys, pretending that she was still there with him. Details of the following crime are few and far between, so I will give you what I've been able to verify, and everything else I'll tell you is speculative, at best. Reportedly, Nancy found herself in Mexico in 1995. I've read multiple articles which have said the family moved there following a transfer of her job. I've read some articles saying that Nancy and Kim were vacationing there. According to several articles, Nancy's remains were discovered in a hotel room in Mexico shortly after her arrival. Several articles state that Nancy had been sexually assaulted and then murdered by strangulation. Others imply that Nancy may have taken her own life. I wish I knew which was true, but honestly, there's almost nothing about this crime out there. Sadly, Nancy Marshall lost her life and went to her grave never knowing the truth of what became of her daughter. If indeed Nancy herself was murdered, that case has been listed as open and unsolved. In the early 2000s, a woman contacted Unsolved Mysteries after viewing a rerun of Nylene's story. According to the woman, she had encountered a man and a woman who had come into a hospital and were behaving strangely. The woman claimed that when the couple were asked questions about their background and medical history, that they ended up leaving and no longer sought medical assistance. The woman believed that it could possibly have been Nylene, and Unsolved Mysteries in turn contacted law enforcement. The FBI managed to track down the unknown woman, and through the use of DNA, conclusively ruled her out as being Nylene Marshall. This was the last development in a case which is now nearing 40 years. If alive today, Nylene would be 40 years old. Is it possible that she could be out there, living under a false name, possibly even her middle name of Kay, and not know that she was abducted all those years ago? There are those who believe Nylene is out there, living her life, completely unaware of her true identity and the incredible grief her real mother suffered through, searching for her all of those years. Others, however, do not believe the letters and calls and think it's much more likely that Nylene was abducted and murdered shortly thereafter. They believe that the young woman had been taken, perhaps even by the man in the purple jogging suit, and that the letters and calls have been little more than pranks. In a case spanning this many years with as few clues as we have, almost anything is possible, and in the absence of solid proof, three main theories have been suggested. The first theory argues that Nylene may simply have wandered off into the forest, become injured or was attacked by a wild animal, and subsequently lost her life in a tragic accident. For many, it's fairly simple to imagine that a four-year-old could easily find herself lost in such a dense forest. The second theory purports that Nylene may have been victimized by someone she knew and trusted. Many believe that Nylene could have been murdered by her own stepfather, while others think it's entirely possible that someone at the picnic that day, who knew Nylene well enough to be trusted by her, may have done something to abduct or murder the young woman. The third and final theory follows the thought process that Nylene may have been abducted by a complete stranger. Many believe that the man in the purple jogging suit and the author of the letters and phone calls may be the same person, and that he did take Nylene. Some do not believe this, and instead believe that Nylene was taken, but that the letters and calls were lies. Regardless, the belief that Nylene could have been taken by an unknown individual remains a possibility. When last seen, Nylene K. Marshall was 4 years old. At the time of her disappearance, Nylene was described as being a Caucasian female with brown hair and blue eyes, standing 3 feet 2 inches tall and weighing approximately 30 pounds. When last seen, Nylene was wearing a yellow t-shirt and shorts with no socks or shoes. Much of this description would have changed in the nearly 40 years since, though Nylene is known to have a mole above her left eyebrow and dimples on both cheeks. Nylene is also known to be right-handed and at the time of her disappearance had a patch of hair on her lower back. She was last seen in the Helena National Forest on June 25, 1983. Nylene Marshall vanished nearly 40 years ago. Over these years, there have been moments where it seemed possible the case could be solved, and other times where law enforcement and the family have been reminded that the likelihood of a positive outcome has become less and less. A family went for a picnic in the forest and came home missing a daughter. Her room, her toys, her clothes sat idly by as constant reminders of what they had truly lost. And as the years passed, her family couldn't help but wonder who the four-year-old may have become. Nancy has since passed away, though Nylene's siblings remain. Will they ever know the truth of what became of their sister? Is Nylene out there somewhere, but unaware of who she truly is? For Nancy, it was a search which never ended. In an interview, she explained, quote, "I still look for her. I always will. Every time I'm at an airport, every time I'm at a resort, every time I'm at an amusement park, I'm sure I look like I'm having a good time, but I'm looking for my child every minute that I'm out."
We need to talk about something. Constipation, abdominal pain, and bloating. You tell yourself that it's not bad. You take laxatives and modify your diet and exercise routine, but thinking about it all the time is frustrating. Do you find yourself making up excuses instead of admitting to people that you don't want to go out because you're worried about leaving home? Despite your best efforts to feel better, your symptoms keep coming back. If this feels all too relatable, you are not alone. If your gut symptoms return again and again, and you don't know why, it may be time to seek help. Like 13 million others, you might have a real medical condition called irritable bowel syndrome with constipation, or IBS-C. To get more information about your symptoms and IBS-C, go to omygut.info/podcast. Learn about your constipation, abdominal pain, and bloating, and if you're ready, find out ways to talk to your doctor or access one online. That's omygut.info/podcast. omygut.info/podcast. Sponsored by Allergan and Ironwood.
The disappearance of Nylene Marshall is an incredibly haunting case. How does a four-year-old surrounded by adults and children alike sit down near a creek less than 100 yards from everyone and mysteriously vanish? Initially, it was thought she got lost. Then the stories began coming out about a man dressed in purple who was seen talking to Nylene. Is it possible that this man, in the midst of being surrounded by all these other people, was so brazen as to just walk away with a child and by some stroke of luck managed to get away with it? That's a question that the family and law enforcement have been asking themselves since the early days of the investigation. Any case involving a child is difficult. Difficult to cover, difficult to listen to. However, I think cases involving children are incredibly important, and while some avoid covering them, I think we owe it to them. Hearing the details about what occurred may be disturbing, but just think about the family that had to endure this horror. For them, there were no easy answers, and nothing could ever assuage the pain and grief they continue to live with. I can't begin to imagine what it feels like to lose a child, and I hope I'll never know. But the strength and courage of those who not only find a way through, but also find a way to keep hoping beyond hope, is something I truly admire. Nearly 40 years ago, a family went on a picnic and one of them didn't come home. For days, searchers, investigators, and volunteers combed through a densely forested area in hopes of locating her. When days began passing more rapidly and not a single trace of the little girl could be found, authorities knew they were dealing with something beyond a little girl going missing. Over the next 40 years, a lot of different possibilities were considered and suspects examined, but when it was all boiled down to what is most commonly believed, everything fits into one of three theories. The first of these theories looks into the initial hypothesis of investigators that Nylene had simply wandered off and gotten lost. While the whole "the person went off of their own volition" theory is one which is typically annoying and doesn't apply to the circumstances, it's difficult to ignore in this case. How likely is it that a four-year-old who loved playing outside might just keep walking off on her own? It happens all around the world every day. Children get lost.
They make poor choices, and when they realize they're lost and don't know the way back, they panic. When that panic sets in, who knows where they could go? Without a sense of direction or a brain developed enough to figure things out, they could spend an entire day walking or running in the wrong direction. Hadn't Eileen done this, she could have found herself deeper into the forest and perhaps in a very dangerous situation. The forest is home to a lot of predators, almost all of which, if Nileen had run into, she'd have been quickly overcome. Both black bears and grizzly bears are known to populate areas of the Helena National Forest. Beyond bears, there are wolves, bobcats, and mountain lions. Were Nileen to have gone off on her own and come across one of these wild animals, the results would likely have been terrible and gruesome. However, had an animal come across Nileen, there'd likely have been some evidence to suggest this. Torn clothing, drag marks, blood. Nothing, though, was ever found. While the initial search only fanned out a few miles from around the point that Nileen disappeared, searches conducted over the years covered much more of the forest and failed to bring back anything. I suppose that's the entire issue with this theory. Nothing's ever been found. In 40 years, no hikers or searchers have found so much as a shred of fabric that might be connected to Nileen. Of course, she was quite small, less than 4 feet tall and weighing about 30 pounds. In 40 years, it's unlikely there'd be much to recover, if indeed Nileen met her fate in that forest. Investigators, years later, even commented that had Nileen somehow died in the forest, it's unlikely they'd be able to find any remains this many years later. It's also unlikely that any searchers are going into caves and areas known to be populated by bears, which leaves the possibility of a lot of locations where Nileen could have been taken. Beyond an animal, the other options don't seem as likely. Some believe Nileen could have drowned in one of the ponds or creeks nearby, but if she did, why wasn't she recovered, especially after they brought in divers and drained many of the ponds? Some believe she could have fallen off a steep embankment, but again, there'd be evidence to find. Blood on the rocks, torn clothing, a body. Still, yet others consider the possibility that Nileen could have gotten injured somehow, either by a fall or by some other method, and found herself caught and unable to escape. While that can't be ignored, we're again faced with the absence of evidence. So is it possible that Nileen met her fate somewhere in the forest? Absolutely, but in terms of likelihood, it's somewhat limited. The searches were extensive and involved hundreds of people. In total, the first search lasted 10 days, and there have been additional searches since that time. Heat-seeking cameras were used. Tracking dogs were brought in. At some point in the 1990s, cadaver dogs were even taken into the area and failed to indicate anything. Sure, it's possible that all of them simply missed where Nileen was, but it's not exactly likely, is it? I'm by no means saying it's impossible that Nileen never left that forest, but it does seem like after extensive searching, within hours of her disappearance, a 4-year-old with no shoes couldn't have gotten very far on her own. Of course, that does leave open the door the possibility that someone else played a role in the 4-year-old's disappearance, and that leads us to the second theory. There are some who believe that whatever happened to Nileen was the result of someone she knew and trusted. We already know that Nileen's stepfather, Kim, was considered a person of interest early on in the investigation. What details or information led authorities to this conclusion, we don't know. But it also isn't uncommon for members of the immediate family to be considered persons of interest following a disappearance. It would make sense to look at the family first. Who else would Nileen have felt safe and comfortable walking away with? Of course, as 40 years passed, it seemed to become apparent that if Kim had played a role in Nileen's disappearance, he'd done so without leaving behind any evidence and managed to keep his composure enough to never let any lies get found out. The logistics of this have always been fascinating to me. How could Nileen's stepfather have committed this crime? He'd have to have gotten his stepdaughter, done something with her, made it back to the picnic area before she was noted as having vanished, and then have stashed her somewhere that none of the searchers ever found. On top of that, the family reported that Kim was never gone and had no time to commit the crime. Kim is certainly a possibility, though it does seem like a stretch when all the facts are laid out. I can easily see him being questioned by authorities in the early days, but once some time had passed, it would seem less likely. Besides that, Nancy loved her daughter and stood by Kim, never believing he was involved in any way. Sure, we've seen mothers do some horrible things to protect the men they love when it comes to their children, but this doesn't seem like one of those situations. One thing which does make me a little curious is that Kim hasn't been involved in any interviews, and even the Unsolved Mysteries segment only showed Nancy, though they made no mention of him being a person of interest. Regardless, though, there just doesn't seem to be enough here to pin it on Kim, not to mention, we have all those reports of the man in purple. So, what if it wasn't Kim, but instead was someone else present at the picnic that day who knew Nylene and was able to use that familiarity to abduct the young girl? That's a possibility that can't be ignored either. We don't know for certain how many people were present at this picnic, though it does seem to have been multi-family. All of the children who saw the man in purple said they did not remember him as being a part of the picnic group, but at the same time, we're dealing with a situation where the oldest child witness is 8, and how reliable can that child's statements truly be? All of the children agreed about the man's appearance, but whether or not he was attached to someone at the picnic, we just can't say for sure. The problem with him possibly being someone who was present at the picnic, though, is very similar to the problems with the Kim theory. How could someone take Nylene, stash her somewhere, or do something terrible to her, then get back to the picnic in time to hear about her disappearance but not be connected to it? Where would this person take a 4-year-old that searchers couldn't locate, and how would this have been executed without someone at the picnic noticing and saying something about it? Not to mention the purple jogging suit. That doesn't exactly blend in, and it seems highly likely that someone would remember seeing him in it. Remember, police spoke to people who had been at the picnic who also reported seeing a man in purple jogging suit, but no one knew who he was. This does seem like the least likely out of the theories. Yeah, there's a chance that someone who knew Nylene was involved, but if so, they did a really good job of covering their tracks. It just doesn't seem possible, and while it can't be ruled out, it's certainly somewhere towards the bottom of the list. Even authorities who questioned everyone present that day never stated anything about suspicious behavior, odd answers, or anything which would have labeled someone as a person of interest. Kim was listed, but again, that seemed to be dismissed rather quickly. For many, it seems most likely that whoever was involved in Nylene's abduction had to be a complete stranger who just happened to be in the forest that day, and that leads us to the third and final theory. Most people, including investigators, believe that Nylene's disappearance is connected to a stranger abduction. The most probable suspect to have committed this abduction is the man in the purple jogging suit, but we know almost nothing about him. All we know is what the children told us, which is that the man at some point came out from behind a tree and began speaking with Nylene. Now let's face it, some random guy walking through a forest and speaking to a child isn't exactly the definition of an abductor, but when the man continues to approach her, getting closer each time, that does begin to make the hair on the back of my neck stand up. Beyond that, we have the account of the little boy, who says the man discussed a game with Nylene about following the shadows. I don't exactly know what that game would be, but if the man explained it to be a game that involved walking or running deeper into the forest, it isn't difficult to imagine Nylene may have gone along. It isn't exactly difficult to convince a 4-year-old who loves the outdoors to follow you deeper into the forest, especially under the guise that you're playing a game together. This whole concept of follow the shadow creeps me out every time I read about it and gives me a great sense of worry and concern for Nylene. Assuming this man managed to get the 4-year-old to walk deeper into the forest with him, at that point, anything could have happened. Remember, Nylene is small and doesn't weigh much. At any point, an adult could have simply scooped her up, covered her mouth, and took off running deeper into the woods, or perhaps somewhere else, like to a waiting car. One thing about the stranger abduction theory that's always bothered me is, how likely is it that some guy with a propensity for abducting children just happened to be in the forest that day? It's a national forest, and anyone's free to go there at any time. It was a Saturday afternoon, so really any number of people could have been present, but how many of them were ready to abduct a child on a whim? But maybe it's not that strange. More than likely, families went out to that area a lot on the weekends, and perhaps this person knew that and simply waited for an opportunity to make a move. Either way, I do believe there's a strong likelihood that whatever happened to Nylene involved the man in the purple jogging suit. The question following the abduction becomes the motive. Unfortunately, there are all manner of sick and twisted reasons someone might abduct a 4-year-old girl. It could have been motivated by money to try and ransom her, though this never happened, so it seems unlikely. There's the possibility that the abductor was a pedophile and saw a young child that he wanted to take. There's also the possibility that the man may have been a murderer and saw a child as an easy target. Again, some believe the man may have wanted a child of his own and sought the opportunity to take one and raise it, as was explained in the letters and calls that came years later. For most people, it comes down to a few possibilities. Either Nylene was taken and murdered rather quickly afterward, as most statistics show that abductors tend to murder their victims within a few days. But what if murder wasn't the intent, and that isn't what took place? Then authorities put forth the idea that the letters may be accurate, and the man who took Nylene did so to raise her as his own daughter. If there's any reason to consider the latter the most likely possibility, it's simply because authorities admitted that some of the details the man mentioned in his letters contained information that was never released to the public, and thus whoever wrote the letters likely was there that day and possibly involved in Nylene's disappearance. Of course, we can't know how much of the letters is true. The man could have easily abducted Nylene and murdered her, then, a few years later, began writing the letters just to taunt the police and the family. The letters and calls all originated from an area surrounding Madison, Wisconsin, and that definitely lends credence to the possibility that both the writer and the caller were the same person. If indeed this is true, then this person abducted Nylene and took her more than 1,300 miles away from her family. Now, some people have wondered, how does a guy just show up one day with a 4-year-old and nobody around him notices? That's an interesting question to examine, but it also falls under the belief that this guy had any friends or family. Sure, neighbors could have noticed, but not if he'd arrived home under the cover of night and kept Nylene concealed in the home. Of course, as she got older, the likelihood that he could have kept her locked away dwindles, and he did speak of traveling with her, but again, we have no way of knowing if that's true. One detail that does make me feel it could be true is when he made the statement, "Nobody questions passports." That just feels like something said out of experience, though it doesn't necessarily mean that this guy actually had Nylene and was raising her. The description the man gives is also upsetting, describing her as growing taller, having her adult teeth coming in. That's one of the major drawbacks when it comes to trying to locate an abducted child. Just 2 or 3 years later, and Nylene could have looked like a completely different person. She would grow and develop. Her features would change, and soon her own family might have difficulty picking her out of a lineup. You figure, by the mid-1990s, when Nylene would have been in her teens, she could have been completely unrecognizable. The man only wrote a few letters and made a few calls within a few years after Nylene had vanished. Why he was driven to do so and why he stopped are questions we simply don't have the answers to. Based on the way the man worded things, the way he talked about Nylene, the alleged love he confessed to have for her, it doesn't take a great mind to determine that there's something wrong with this person. Not to mention his whole statement about the medicine he gave Nylene, which I'm not going to repeat. This is not a stable individual, and that means that Nylene, regardless of what she remembers, would be in danger every day. Who knows when this guy's mind might change and he might take her life, or worse. It's an incredibly scary situation to imagine a young child being in, especially if, as the years passed, her memories of home began to fade, and she truly believed this man was her father. It seems, more than likely, that Nylene was taken from the Helena National Forest that day. Who took her and why remains unknown, and the closest we've got to clues are the letters and phone calls. In a best-case scenario, Nylene is alive and 40 years old, living a good life completely unaware of her true identity. While that possibility does little to grant her family a reprieve, it does, to some degree, provide the option that Nylene may have lived her life, accomplished many things, and could even be happily married and a mother herself. This would hardly be the first time an adult has discovered that they were abducted as a child. There is also, sadly, the possibility that Nylene's life was taken, either quickly following her abduction or sometime in the years after. Her abductor, 40 years later, would likely be in his late 60s or 70s, if he was still alive. It seems unlikely that this guy just woke up one day and decided to abduct a child. I think it's likely that Nylene was not his first attempt, though it may have been his first success. I wouldn't be surprised if the guy has been arrested, before or since the abduction, on some kind of a charge relating to a crime against a minor. There's a good chance that his name is written in an old detective's notepad, collecting dust somewhere. But whether or not his identity will be uncovered and Nylene's fate revealed remains unknown. Nylene K. Marshall was 4 years old when she vanished into the Helena National Forest. She'd be 40 years old if alive today and possibly unaware of her identity. Her abductor, if alive, could be parading himself as her biological father and may have raised her somewhere in the area of Madison, Wisconsin. Unfortunately, after 40 years and few clues, the likelihood that this case is going to be solved drops a little more each year, but there's still the hope that the truth will be revealed. Every day, cold cases are being solved thanks to genetic research and new technologies. Perhaps one day someone, or even Nylene herself, will take a DNA test and reveal the truth. Until that happens, or police manage to break through, the disappearance of Nylene K. Marshall remains open, unsolved, and 40 years cold. If you're looking for more information on the disappearance of Nylene Marshall, there are some news articles available online and forums discussing her case. Unsolved Mysteries did a short segment on her case. If you have any information about the disappearance of Nylene Marshall, please contact the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children or the FBI. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod. Email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com, Instagram message me at traceevidencepod, or comment in the Facebook group. A special shout out and thank you to Trace Evidence Patreon producers Alicia Lorraine, Krista Colvin, Deani Dyson, Eamon Brady, Emily Smith, Julia Rexon, Kate Alexander, Megan, Randy Weiland, Chandra Moreau, Tara Doble, Megan Cotter, and Tom Archer. Trace Evidence wouldn't be possible without the kindness of all of you amazing listeners. Visit patreon.com/traceevidence for more information. Just a quick heads up to everyone, there will not be an episode next Monday, June 10th. I will be attending CrimeCon this week, and I'm going to take next week off to regroup and gather some information. However, I'm going to be attempting to do some live streams while present, so if you're not already a member of the Trace Evidence discussion group on Facebook, you may wish to join. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of Trace Evidence, and I hope you'll join me in 2 weeks when I examine another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.